G'day humans, welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas, the one, the only, Rich Roll. The crowd goes wild as Rich walks into the Uncomfortable Conversations arena. Athlete, activist, podcaster, guru. I ask him if he's a guru. You'll have to listen to the episode to find out his answer. Rich, if you don't know him, is one of the most influential people in the land of the pods. What is he? He's a best-selling author. That's how he first came to many people's attention, because about a decade ago, he published a memoir called Finding Ultra, Rejecting Middle Age, Becoming One of the World's Fittest Men, and Discovering Myself. So he's an Ultraman. Like, these are, so, do you know Ultraman competitions? They take a marathon and then like a, you know, a superhuman, what do you call, like Iron Man thing, and then they go even further. The most difficult thing that you can do to the human body in the world. You know, 3 day long, hundreds and hundreds of kilometers of swimming and cycling and running. And I mean, just to me, this is hell. This is the worst thing you could. If you gave me the choice of doing an ultra marathon or an Ultraman competition, and then or you could kill me, I would think long and hard about which one. And they may even be the same outcome either way, depending on my level of fitness. And what's interesting about Rich is he didn't get into this until he was in middle age. He was an entertainment lawyer, a drunk, like just skimming along, you know, highly educated, went to Cornell and Stanford, and, you know, basically drank his life away in his 20s and then ate a lot in his 30s. And as he was about to turn 40, was like, am I going to keep going on this trajectory? He was like, no, I'm going to do the exact complete 100% opposite thing, and has now built a massive global empire of sort of Rich Roll books and podcasts and recipes and ways of life. He's full on vegan. He is a lifestyle brand. I mean, if you don't know Rich, but you know Gwyneth Paltrow's Goop, that's an unkind analogy. That would be a very unkind analogy to make, and that's why I'm not going to make it right now. Nonetheless, that's probably all you need to know about Rich. If you don't know him, if you do know him, you know what an articulate and thoughtful person he is, and what an inspiring person he is. I mean, his podcast, the Rich Roll podcast, which has now branched out from being just about wellness into being about all, I mean, interviewing people who have interesting ideas about all spheres of human creativity and knowledge and understanding. It's a wonderful playground to dip yourself into, and I was super stoked to be able to sit down with Rich, virtually, of course, and have this conversation. Hope you enjoy it with the one and only Rich Roll.
I'm a little sidelined.
What happened?
Just chronic lower back problems, L4, L5, sciatic pain. I'm trying to sort it out right now, so haven't been able to do the running that I would prefer to be doing right now.
Would prefer to be doing or feel like you ought to be doing?
That's a very insightful question. I think I've let go of the ought to, should aspect of it. There is a part of it that I just love doing. And when I can't do it, I don't quite feel like myself. It's not really about performance goals anymore. It's just about the joy of doing it. And I miss that part of it right now.
And where is the joy? Like, at what point of the process is the joy?
Well, I think,
like, yeah, I see, like, if I looked at your face when you're finishing an ultra marathon, whereas you're crossing the finish line, your face does not look contented, you know?
Fair enough.
Like, oh, I love running a marathon. I'm like, really? Because I've been at the finish line of marathons and not a single person looked happy.
Well, I think there's two different things happening here. I think the day-to-day kind of training, once you get past sort of getting into shape, like decent shape for doing the thing, there is a joyful component to it. That is very primal, like just you alone on a trail, just the voice, the sound of your breath and just the silence and, you know, being alone with your thoughts. It is kind of an active meditation, and it just, it makes me like in the way, you know, like finishing just a daily kind of training run makes me feel like whole. You know, I don't know. I always finish those runs. I feel more in my body and I feel clarity in my mind. And I also am able to like problem solve and relieve stress. There's all these benefits, you know, that I experience as a result of that kind of endeavor. Of course, doing a race like that is a different thing. It's a very difficult thing, but there's a satisfaction and a joy that comes with completing something that perhaps you didn't think you were capable of doing that has a long-term impact. Of course, in the moment of doing it, it's not joy in the conventional sense of how you would think of it, but in the aftermath of it, there's a sense of accomplishment that I think is quite beneficial. You know, I don't think like perpetually running ultra marathons is a recipe for longevity and optimal health. But it, you know, it has its place.
Yeah. I'm interested that you admit that joy is not present during the process, but the thing is worth having done. I mean, it's a bit am I getting that wrong?
No, I mean, you know, there's that thing of you sign up for something really hard that's scary enough that you take the preparation seriously. And then when you're on the starting line, there's butterflies and excitement. And then in the middle of it, as soon as it starts to get hard, you're cursing yourself and wondering like, why in the hell did I sign up for this? How can I get out of this? All of that kind of stuff. But I think, you know, that struggle, that kind of grappling, with your own limitations and putting yourself intentionally in a difficult situation where there's no easy way out is how we grow. Right.
Yeah.
And there is real value in that. And I'm not sure that society is appropriately configured around, you know, challenging ourselves in that way. Otherwise, we wouldn't see this explosion in not only marathons and triathlons, but like the whole ultra world. I mean, that started out as, you know, just a ragtag group of people who would pitch tents, you know, out in the woods to, you know, go run anonymously, you know, some race that no one's ever heard of and no one will ever hear of. And now, like, it's kind of entered the popular zeitgeist or, vocabulary of kind of things to sign up for. So, to what do we account that, right? Like, people need that in their life, as uncomfortable as it is, because they're extracting some kind of value out of it.
I mean, anything that's worth doing is probably hard, right? And so that process of you sign up for it, you're excited about it, then you reach the dark depth of the soul moment of the whole project where you think, why the hell did I do this? And then you emerge victorious and you're ultimately satisfied and exhausted. Like, that's the process of writing a book. That's the process of putting together a one-man stand-up show. That's the process of making a movie. That's the process of doing anything difficult. There's always the process, the actual doing of it is always full of moments that you dislike, but you think in aggregate. I mean, it's the process of having kids in a way, isn't it? So I wonder whether or not the rise in interest in ultra marathons and marathons is partly, I don't know, an easy sort of psychologically containable way to understand goals and a kind almost a manageable goal in a way?
I suppose. Yeah. I mean, I think there
is.
It's easier
than starting a startup, you know, it's easier than becoming Elon. It's something that has a defined period in time and a defined series of steps that can make it happen.
It will end and you will either finish or not. And along the way, you're going to be
alive.
you're going to have to grapple, you know, with the dark, you know, recesses of the soul. And you're either going to come out on the other side of that, having, sort of proudly battled with it, or you will have faltered. Either way, you're going to learn something about yourself. And if sitting on the couch and just watching Netflix all day in your super comfy condo was a recipe to happiness, then, you know, we wouldn't see the kind of explosion in, you know, these sorts of events from Spartan to ultra marathons. Like, I do think that there is something missing that we're seeking that speaks to what it is that makes us human, that's outside of the incessant marketing messages that are telling us that, you know, the fancy car or the new job or, you know, the kind of luxury vacation is going to satisfy. And I find that very interesting. Like right now, the big thing is these dark retreats, right? Where you go and you lock yourself in a dark room for multiple days and you pay for that. Like, you know, where did that come from?
I don't even know about these. Tell me.
You don't know about this?
How have I missed the dark retreats?
You haven't heard about this. So this became part of the kind of, popular parlance because Aaron Rodgers, who's a, you know, well-known NFL quarterback, decided that he was going to go into the dark room to try to figure out whether he was going to stay in the NFL for another year or not. And there's a couple places across the U.S., one in particular in Oregon, where, yes, you go into this room for, I think it's like 4 days, and they slide food once a day, you know, through this sort of little latch. So no light gets into the room and you're just alone with your thoughts. You know,
fucking latch, Rich. That's yes. Poetry. I mean, that's what we do. The worst. That's
being paid. We are paying for solitary confinement, Josh. So from, you know, what do we extract from, you know, the rising popularity of this as a choice to how to spend our vacation time?
I mean, I guess we extract the assumption that Gitmo should have been bigger. We should have expanded Guantanamo Bay to more and more thankful jihadis and given them
your new tourist destination.
Exactly.
An experiential, vacation.
Yeah, we were sending the wrong people there. We should have been sending aspirational NFL, you know, quarterbacks who want to figure out what they're doing with their lives instead of Al-Qaeda. That's amazing. So how long do you spend in one of these cells?
I think the typical stay is 4 days. So I have a friend, Colin O'Brady, who's an adventure athlete, who's done it. He's getting ready to go back in for a second time, I think. He did it recently and reported back to me how amazing it was, how revelatory it was just to be, you know, when you can't escape your mind, Josh, is there any scarier place to be?
No. That's why I'm not going to be doing a dark room.
Right. Right.
These are anyone who's done some kind of silent meditation retreat. Like I've been on your 5-night Deepak Chopra Southern California thing where, one of the days nobody's talking to each other. And that alone is challenging enough, but at least you can see that there are other human beings in the world and sunlight. Like this could be psychologically dangerous to be in the dark for 4 days.
I would imagine. That it's not for everybody.
Amazing. I mean, it does make me wonder, just coming back to endurance, you know, the achievement and the benefits that people get from these extremely hard physical endurance events, whether now that you've done them, I mean, no one can accuse you of being lazy or, you know, given the number of Ultraman championships that you've done. So when you do it, when you are now running, purely recreationally, all of the things that you were saying you get from that, like you're alone with your thoughts and there's no sort of psychological input. There's just you and nature and the sounds and the breeze and a sort of sense of presence. Couldn't you get that by walking?
Yeah, I guess you could. I think there's something about, you know, the elevated heart rate in that aerobic zone that seems to, you know, heighten the experience for me. And, you know, upon completion, feeling like you did, you know, kind of clear out the cobwebs in a way that like a walk doesn't achieve. And I'm just speaking, you know, for myself and my own experience. I mean, I think that, you know, the trick with endurance sport and perhaps even, you know, more acutely ultra endurance sports is they can become addictive. Like they take so much time out of your life to prepare for. And, you know, I think that they are incredible reservoirs for developing a deeper connection with yourself and for a better sense of self-understanding. And also the, you know, kind of esteem building of realizing that you're capable of accomplishing more than perhaps you realize that you are able to, that spills over into other areas of your life. But I also think you can get stuck in that paradigm or that modality. You know, and for me, it's, you know, I'm grateful that I was able to learn a lot from that world, but I don't feel the need to constantly compete to, you know, prove anything to myself or to anyone else. And I've kind of extracted what I needed to learn from that. And now I feel very nourished in kind of applying that to other areas of my life that, you know, provoke curiosity or that I'm interested in exploring. Mm. And I think when you realize like, hey, I didn't think I could do this in this other area, or I learned so much about myself by dint of exploring this subculture, where are the other areas of my life that I'm ignoring or perhaps, you know, in denial about, where if I shined a light on them, you know, I could grow in other facets of this, you know, lived experience.
I mean, it's interesting that you use the word addiction, because it does, I do sometimes wonder when people are as like as obsessive as you are with something like this. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm going to sort of be impolite enough to ask until later on we know each other a bit better. But since you mention it, like, I know that you've had your struggles with drugs and alcohol in your 20s. Like, are you just an addict who has swapped one low status unhealthy addiction for a higher status healthier one?
Yeah, I mean, I get that question a lot, and I think the sort of flippant response is to, you know, deny that reality. But I think, you know, it's worthy of recognizing that there are certainly aspects of that. Like, if you go to any Ironman race or ultra distance race, there are so many addicts in recovery. You know, lots of tattoos, lots of people who, you know, built their lives back up from some form of broken state. And there is a very specific allure in the endurance world that plays on the mind of the recovering addict, because it's an opportunity to kind of, you know, venture beyond the limits, to go to that unknown place, to, you know, leverage an experience to kind of, you know, go beyond like what it feels like to be normal. And the addict is always looking for, you know, peak states of consciousness, right? Like, on some level, you know, an addict is a seeker. Like, they're looking for answers. They're just doing it in a very unhealthy way. And I think endurance sports provides a healthier alternative to that, to, you know, explore that inner experience of, you know, what it means to touch up against a peak experience, or to take yourself beyond, you know, what the normal person feels. But it can be addictive. And I'd be lying if I didn't say that wasn't part of the allure, or that I haven't at times had, you know, a less than completely healthy relationship with that sport. But I think that on the, you know, by and large and on the whole, you know, taking the drug or taking the drink is always kind of the backdoor exit. It's the easy choice. And strapping on the running shoes, you know, when it's dark out and cold out and you don't want to do it, is a hard choice. And it's a growth opportunity. So they don't line up completely in that paradigm.
No, of course.
So,
of course.
Yeah.
You know what else is a hard choice is locking yourself in a dark fucking room for 4 days.
I know.
That's also on the hard choice. And yet there's something strangely, that's such an interesting phenomenon. Now that you've opened that Pandora's box, I'm going to have to go down the rabbit hole and investigate that, because it's one of those things where it's a hard choice to make initially, but then the choice is sort of out of your hands. Then the journey takes care of itself, almost like doing acid or something. You know what I mean?
But
like,
here's the thing. You're not locked in. You can leave at any time.
Well, of course. I mean, that would be criminal, probably.
Right.
But there must be a strong disincentive. It must be like, oh, well, you've pressed the emergency red button and now you've failed the whole thing, kind of, if I get now.
Right? Sure. But imagine the experience of not knowing what time it is and not even being quite sure what day it is. Like, how much longer Do I have to be in here? Is this day two or day three? When I fell asleep, did I fall asleep for an hour or 10 hours? Like, it's a mind fuck from top to bottom.
Absolutely amazing. You know, I got a little sick last week just having kids, and, you know, they bring it back from school or whatever. And so I had a bit of a fever, and I had a funny tummy, and I had one of those nights where, you know, when you're kind of tossing and turning and you're hot and you swear you've got the cold sweats and you've got the hot shivers a little bit, and you keep looking at the clock to see what time it is, and you think it must be morning by now, and the clock says 12:03 a.m. and you go, oh fuck, I can't believe I've got another 5 hours until I can get up. Like, it must just be like that, but for 96 hours.
I don't know. I'm tempted. I'm tempted to try it.
You're
going to
do it. You're going to do it. I can hear it in your voice.
We should do it together.
You are.
You did. Like, I wonder if you can like knock on the wall to the guy in the cave, you know, the next cave over.
I love it. I love the idea. I love the idea that you're going to be in Sydney in May, and you know, I'm going to get a call, and you'll be like, "Hey, it's Rich. Do you want to go and get brunch?" And I'll be like, "Sure." And when we get there, I'll be like, "I haven't seen this place." And you'll be like, "Just come down, come through down this hallway. It's just down the back." I'll be like, "Rich, where are you taking me? Where are you taking me, Rich?" "No, no, the brunch is just back here." And then slam, and you and I are just in the dark room.
We've made arrangements for your kids. I talked to your, you know, everybody at the studio. You're fine.
I'm fine.
You got your days cleared.
Oh my goodness. What were your drugs of? You were talking about how easy it is to like to drink. I mean, alcohol is such a mediocre drug. God, it's boring. But were you into more fun drugs when you were a drug addict?
No, you know, I was pretty much a purist, to be honest, a throwback. That was my thing. You know, I dabbled in a few other things. I never tried cocaine. I was terrified of it. I think I knew that if I'd ever tried that, it would be game over pretty quickly. So my addiction story is pretty conventional and tepid in that regard. There's nothing, you know, super, you know, kind of sexy about it. It was just sort of a sad and pathetic, you know, drunkard story.
Yeah, right. You're probably lucky. You dodged a bullet on coke, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because that can not be pretty. We've all seen what that can do.
Sure. I mean, I think I probably would have loved it. And it either would have gotten me sober sooner, or it would have killed me, or just wreaked, you know, exponentially more havoc in my life. But,
yeah,
you know, it got dark enough for me to, you know, have a reckoning and change course. And I'm, you know, very grateful for that.
And did rehab work?
It did. You know, I kind of came in on the recommendation of a judge and the police and, you know, some parents and some friends who thought it would be wise that maybe I should take a look at my habits.
How did you get involved in the law? Was this a driving thing, or what did you do?
I mean, it was a slow decline for many years. And then I moved to Los Angeles, and I got two DUIs in rapid fire succession within a period of, I think they were like 6 weeks in between both of them. And was facing two DUI charges, jail time, like, you know, all kinds of pretty severe consequences. And it's a long story, but one of the cases got thrown out because they lost the file, which was a crazy miracle, and ended up getting charged with just one DUI. But that was enough. I mean, the second one that I got picked up in the first one, I rear-ended an elderly woman at like 3 a.m. at an intersection. The second one, 6 weeks later, got picked up in Beverly Hills driving the wrong way down a one-way street. I blew like 2.9 and 2.7. You know, like I was gone, like big time. Like, this is not like it was serious. And the second one, the cop who arrested me knew my boss, the partner in the law firm where I was an associate, because my boss was representing the police department in a number of cases. And so my boss called me in on Monday morning after I spent the weekend in jail and said, "Listen, I got an interesting call over the weekend. Like, you're all fucked up, and you got to sort this out. And I wish I could tell you that I got sober immediately and everything was rosy after that. That's not what happened. It was a situation in which I guess I needed a little bit more pain and to go to a darker place. But ultimately, you know, I was in enough psychic and emotional pain and just a state of loneliness in which, you know, I was alienated from my family and just, you know, all of my good friends had kind of fled for the hills. And I realized that the only way out was through, and decided. I just woke up one morning, and it was a morning that wasn't that dissimilar from so many other mornings that I had woken up hungover, but I just had a brief window of willingness to do something different and got myself to a rehab up in Oregon, where I thought I was just going to spin dry for a couple of weeks and get back to my, you know, quote unquote, very important job, and ended up instead staying for 100 days. And that really saved my life and created a foundation of sobriety that, you know, allowed me to kind of come back to Los Angeles and build upon. And, you know, I really credit that to saving my life.
That's amazing. How did you afford it? I always wonder with rehab, to all these Americans who are going to rehab, like the recovery process from addiction seems so much more prosaic and arduous outside of the United States, where people just kind of muddle through and we don't have the same, I guess, reliance on rehab centers as there seems to be in America. Aren't they expensive? Who pays for it?
Yeah, it's a situation that's not exactly covered by insurance in the way that it should be. And in my case, I cashed out my meager 401k, and then my parents kind of matched that to make it work.
Right.
So I was lucky in that regard. And, you know, I had been in it because the judge, I got the nudge from the judge, and I was going to AA meetings to get my court card signed, but I wasn't doing it to get sober. I was doing it to get, you know, people off my back. And, you know, I needed a deeper, you know, kind of immersion into, you know, I needed to be extracted out of my life in order to only focus on this. And that's not to say that.
I like that phraseology.
That's one of many, you know, one of many like kind of annoying aphorisms out of the 12-step world.
I think we should produce a reality television show modeled off Judge Judy or Judge Joe Brown, where you play the judge, and it's called A Nudge from the Judge with Rich Roll.
Uh-huh.
And it's people with addiction problems, and you come in and you go, you just got the nudge from the judge, and the person gets sent to rehab.
I think it would be boring, though, because I would just send everyone to rehab.
Yeah. I just enjoy a brandy once at Christmas, once a year. Rehab for you. You got the nudge.
Exactly.
Judge.
Yeah.
And, well, that's. I'm glad that that all that worked. What do you say to people who are not in such a... Also, it's interesting you said you're... I just want to follow up. Your friends had abandoned you. Often, people who have drinking problems are enabled by their social environment, and that becomes part of the problem. Well, what would I do? You know, how would I have fun when I go out all the time with all my other alcoholic buddies who reinforce each other's drinking habits if I was sober? That wasn't the case for you?
Yeah, well, I think that's a case of what we call lower companions, Josh. Like as this disease progresses, there's a certain, you know, kind of color that the people that you hang out with, tend to become. Like you sort of, it's not that my friends abandoned me. They just sort of slowly, you know, step backward from you. And also on top of that, like a big piece of addiction is a deepening of your, you know, kind of isolating from the world, because you know that your behavior is not kind of socially approved. And so you start hanging out with people that aren't your friends, but are the ones that will not really call you out on your bullshit because they're on your wavelength. Yeah. So you start hanging out with those people. And then when those people start backing away from you, you know, you're kind of going into an even darker place. And
So
my good friends were kind of unavailable, and I was hanging out with people that I wouldn't ordinarily hang out with. And I was also, you know, isolating and spending a lot of time alone in my apartment, drinking by myself. Which is, you know, for those of you out there, strong indicia that you might have a problem. And just, you know, making decisions that I just wouldn't ordinarily make. And my parents being very clear in saying, like, listen, we love you, but like, we just can't stand by while you continue to behave this way. If and when you're ready to get sober, we love you and we're here from you. But until then, like, you're on your own with this adventure that you're on.
And it turns out that was the right approach by them.
Yeah. I mean, that was very painful, you know, very painful. Mm. And so, you know, at that dark, you know, that darkest hour, I felt desperately alone, you know, and, you know, realized that I had to change. But it's so tricky because you don't want to let go of this thing that has become your best friend, even though you know intellectually it's destroying your life.
Mm.
And that's the confusing part of addiction that makes it very difficult for like normal people to understand. Like, why can't you just quit? Can't you see the damage that this is doing? But it's not something that resides in the intellectual part of the mind. And as they say, another kind of annoying aphorism is that sobriety isn't for people that need it. It's for people that want it. And it's always, you know, bizarre, like who's able to get sober and who isn't. Like it's never who you think.
Mm.
And the people you think have got a hold on it end up relapsing. And the people you think, oh, that guy's never going to make it, you know, ends up putting together 20 years of sobriety. Like it's mystifying still, you know, I think this disease. And I think the fact that it's so mystifying creates a lot of problems with normal people trying to understand like how to solve it, especially when you have a loved one who's struggling. Like, how do you help that person? You know, do you stand on the sidelines and let them hit bottom so that they develop their own willingness? Or do you intervene? And if you intervene, how do you intervene in a way that's going to produce the desired results?
Mm. It's so true, because from the outside, what seems to be reasonable or rational is to point out to the person the ways in which their consumption is unhealthy or problematic. And as you say, when the sober person says to the addict, why don't you quit? Can't you see all of the problems that it's causing in your life? Inside the addict's head, they go, yeah, it's causing all of these fucking problems. So how do you expect me to deal with them except for with a drink?
Right. So on the one hand, they're also
need to have a drink. Wouldn't you want to have a drink if you were an alcoholic? Like if your life was ruined by alcoholism, you know, how am I going to deal with this without a drink?
Yeah. On the one hand, you're like, fuck off. I'm not hurting anyone. Why do you care? Leave me alone. This is, you know, my thing, not yours. So stay away. And on the other hand, you know, the kind of pain that this lifestyle produces means that you have to keep using drugs or alcohol to, you know, mask that pain because that pain is so unbearable and it becomes this, you know, sort of snowball rolling downhill.
Yeah, that's interesting. Did you ever think, were you ever under the illusion that it was fun?
Well, it was fun for a long time. And I think that's the other piece that people don't really appreciate. Like,
what was fun about
another, again, I'm just going to keep throwing these annoying, you know, kind of phrases at you, but like another one is it works until it doesn't. Like it works until it stops working. And the reason that you go on this journey is because it does work. And for a certain period of time, it's fun and you feel great. And you're like, this is the answer to every question, you know, in my life. Like this is the solution to every problem that I didn't even know that I had. I wish I had discovered this sooner. I want to feel like this all the time. I want to feel like this all day long. And so that kind of cements this relationship with the substance that, you know, ultimately, you know, what you can't see at that time is that it will turn on you. And in my case, it was a very kind of progressive, you know, degradation of the things that I cared about in my life. Like as somebody who, you know, I was somebody, Josh, who kind of struggled academically and was kind of an insecure kid who had difficulty making friends and wasn't quite sure how to interact with other human beings, shy, you know, kind of bookish. And I went to a school that was all about sports and football and all of that. I never really you know, figured out how I could connect with other people. And so I had this like kind of profound internal confusion about life, thinking that everyone else had this roadmap or this handbook for how to live that I lacked, and I just was walking around confused. At the same time, I did figure out, like, I became this swimmer and I excelled academically. And so by the time I graduated from high school, I'd gotten accepted into all these fancy schools, and I go off to Stanford, and I'm a swimmer at Stanford, and swimming at Stanford is cool. Like, and so suddenly I'm in the cool crowd for the first time, and I discover alcohol. And it was like this warm blanket being wrapped around me, telling me that everything was okay. And I felt comfortable in my skin for the very first time. And it was like this epiphany experience that, you know, basically, you know, kind of rooted in me this idea of wanting to feel like that all the time. And I had a great time in college. I had a lot of fun. I went to all the parties. I learned how to be a social person. I learned how to talk to a girl and, like, you know, dance or do all the things that seemed like normal people already knew how to do. And so on some level, it was like a teacher. But it wasn't long before I didn't really care about whether I showed up for swim practice anymore, or is it really all that important that I turn in this paper on time? And, you know, it's that's what's kind of insidious about the whole thing, is that it starts very gradually, you know. And I was functional for a long time and ended up going to law school, and God knows how I graduated law school, but I could keep it together just enough. But the more it progresses, the more you bifurcate your life, and you have the life that you live around other people, and then you have this secret life that you know you're ashamed of, that you're hiding from, that's driving that kind of you to further and further isolate from other people, until, you know, those two worlds kind of come into conflict with each other. And that's when, you know, chaos starts to kind of, you know, blossom in various areas of your life. and you can continue to, you know, be in denial over that for a certain period of time until it becomes so obvious to everyone around you that you're forced to confront it in a certain kind of way. And either those are the moments in which you have a decision, like, are you going to deal with this and rectify your life and get sober and choose a new path for yourself? Or are you going to say fuck you to everybody and just, you know, self-destruct? And, you know, I've been to a lot of funerals, and I've seen a lot of people not able to make that leap, or, you know, flirt with sobriety, or, you know, have certain stints with sobriety, but are unable to maintain it because they're not dealing with the underlying, you know, kind of pain that led them to that behavior in the first place. And, you know, a lot of people don't make it and die. And so I'm very, you know, grateful that I was able to, you know, kind of come out the other side of it.
And when those chaos monkeys showed up, when you say it was the kind of the role of professional lawyer and upstanding, highly educated professional smashes into the role of alcoholic. Were you drinking at work? Was that like bleeding into your work life?
At the very end, yeah. At the very end, it was. I mean, not initially, but when it got really dark, and there's a whole like kind of wedding. I got married and it ended on the honeymoon story. That's like a 2-hour soap opera that, you know, like contributed to, you know, the me kind of, you know, really touching up against, you know, the darkest aspects of my story, and ultimately leading me to being the guy who's on a leaving Las Vegas trajectory of having a vodka tonic in the shower and hiding drinks throughout the day, and, you know, believing that I'm getting away with this and nobody knowing about it. And, you know, until like the whole kind of house of cards topples onto your head and you're forced to, you know, really get honest with yourself.
It's interesting that you say that it was fun until it wasn't, because have you heard of the Alan Carr group of organization? They help people quit smoking and drinking and drugs, but they take it's a British organization, And like Richard Branson and like Anthony Hopkins and a bunch of top Brits swear by it. But it takes an opposite kind of view to traditional 12 steps in encouraging you to, and that's how I stopped drinking a few years ago, encouraging you to think, to very closely and pay close attention to what's actually happening when you're drinking and how much of the fun actually comes from the drink and how much of the fun that you associate with the drink is the drink piggybacking on environments that are already fun and piggybacking on environments that are already not fun. And it's interesting. It's like, I mean, their basic philosophy is that there aren't alcoholics and non-alcoholics, that alcohol itself or any addictive substance functions by creating a narrative around it that is full of bullshit that we buy into from a pretty young age. And then when we start consuming it socially and culturally, it's close enough to the truth to get its claws into us. And it's only a one-way trajectory really for everybody, but there are enough pressures to avoid having another drink that exists in most people's lives that they can walk the tightrope of addiction. But fundamentally, it is an addictive substance that really only sort of seems like it's fun kind of because it's addictive. And people who never drink, if you're a Hindu or if you're a Muslim, you don't go around a wedding wishing you could, you know, moaning about how you can't have a drink the way that someone who drinks who isn't allowed to have a drink does. The desire for the drink is caused by the fact that you drink all the time. And the moment you're not drinking all the time and you realize that you don't need to be drinking all the time is the moment that you're kind of free from the desire to drink as well. And so when I think back about the fun of alcohol, yes, it's a slight anesthetic. Yes, it probably gave you it lowered your inhibitions occasionally in terms of dancing or talking to girls when you're in college and feeling awkward. That's fine. Lots of anesthetics could probably do that. But what it really was it was piggybacking on your experience of coming out of your shell and the natural experience that a lot of people have in their early 20s of growing a pair of balls and realizing that they can do things that they previously thought that they can't and feeling confident in themselves and beginning to feel like a grown up. And psychologically, alcohol comes along for the ride there. And that's probably the source of the illusion of fun. Does that any of that land?
Yeah. I mean, I think, I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. I think that my response to that would be that, well, two things. First of all, the longer I've kind of been sober and the more kind of conversations that I have on my podcast and just socially with people in the addiction recovery and kind of psychiatry space, I've become more convinced that addiction lives on a much greater spectrum than we tend to think of it. Like, we tend to think of addicts as, you know, people that can't pull the needle out of their arm, or, you know, the drunk in the gutter and the paper bag and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I think on some level, as human beings, we're all prone to, you know, various compulsive behaviors, whether they're substance oriented or not, to which we, you know, lack a certain level of control or agency. And I think, you know, our phones have been a great example that have taught us like how powerless we can be at times over our own impulses. Movies like The Social Dilemma, where we realize like these slot machine, you know, kind of features and the technology that's gone into these devices, you know, make us behave around our phones in a way that, you know, we wouldn't otherwise, which makes us think like, how much agency do I really have? Like, what is the difference between the obsessive compulsive kind of relationship that I have with technology or social media, you know, versus addiction? And I think, you know, whether it's alcoholism or drug addiction or gambling, you know, there's a whole other kind of world that falls into this addiction conversation that is less addressed, like what about the person who keeps getting into the same kind of dysfunctional relationship, or you know, the person that just, you know, whatever, when as soon as they're standing in line or they have a moment of boredom, they just compulsively pull out their phone and go to TikTok or whatever it is, right? Like this is, you know, something that's bred into us as human beings, and it can be relatively benign or just mildly invasive into the quality of our life, or it can be utterly devastating and debilitating in the context of, you know, somebody who just gambles away all their money, or, you know,
right. But I don't think, but I think to locate the problem in the somebody who's gambling away their money, or in a particular attribute of that person, as if they were born addicted to gambling, and they were just waiting, like the gambling monster inside them was just waiting for the moment to play the first slot machine. That is a narrative that is popular among 12-step types that is rejected by this philosophy that I'm talking about, which says that these things will inevitably, if you allow them, in every case, lead to a catastrophic outcome. It's just that we're all pretty good at holding our shit together. Like the dope, what happens when you pull your phone out of your pocket and you get a little dopamine hit of noticing that there's a notification or a like on something that you've posted or seeing something interesting, is that you get this little dopamine hit, and then the next time you're waiting in line, you remember that dopamine hit and you do it again and again and again and again, and the dopamine hit gets less and less and less. So you have to do it more and more to get the same amount of interest and innovation and stimulation from your phone. And all of a sudden, Instagram seems a bit boring, so TikTok seems more interesting. And, you know, at some point, you know, if you are not around other people, porn will seem more interesting still, or whatever is increasingly addictive. I mean, there is only one trajectory in order to maintain the same level of novelty that the thing gave you in the first place, and that is to keep consuming it in ever greater amounts. It's just that most of us have duties that prevent us from doing that. But once you notice that that's the game is just, I mean, think about it with a heroin junkie or a smoker or something. You have the first one, it does something for you. The second one does a little bit less. The third one does a little bit less. And before you know it, you're not quite sure why you're going back for the cigarette, because it's not giving you the head spin that the first one did. But you know that you feel a little bit uncomfortable without it. And the cigarette is just creating, I mean, the permanent trough that you live in, which the cigarette is then the solution to bring you up to feeling the way that non-smokers feel all the time. And when you're having a cigarette, you feel as good as non-smokers do all the time. But then as the nicotine bleeds out of your system, you gradually fall into a trough that your addiction to nicotine is causing. And that as a model is basically just the way that addiction works. And it works on all of us equally. Some of us are just good enough at distracting ourselves with our duties of work and family and ambition and whatever, that we don't allow our usage to get to such a high level that the trough becomes so deep that we can't climb back out of it. Anyway.
I hear what you're saying. And I would agree that these things always move in one direction, which is, you know, increased dosage as we, you know, kind of acclimate to the dose. And you know, it never ends up in a good place, right? Like there is that one singular path, but I would add a ripple to that, which is, I do think that there are certain people who are just wired differently. And perhaps that has to do with childhood trauma or their genetic makeup. You know, I can't quite identify, you know, specifically the nature of that, but I can tell you in my own experience, from the very first time that I drank alcohol, I know that my experience and my relationship with that was different from that of my peers. Like, yeah, right. I immediately was the guy who was the last to leave the party, who was, you know, drinking the half-filled empties with cigarette butts in them at the keg party, like doing all kinds of crazy shit that like none of my friends were doing, right? Like, and that only continued to escalate. So I think there is something qualitatively different, at least with respect to alcoholism, where that substance has a very different impact qualitatively on that type of individual that, you know, creates a result that is, that is much more negative than the person who's like, yeah, I binge drink too much, or once in a while I drink too much. And, you know, so, and I would couch this in saying that I'm very much a product of 12 step, and that's my indoctrination, and that's what saved my life. And I know there's always these new modalities, and people are finding new ways of looking at the nature of this, you know, disease. I call it a disease. Some people don't. And finding, you know, treatment solutions in psychedelic substances or in, you know, childhood trauma therapy, et cetera. And I even had, you know, to speak to your earlier point, this friend of mine, Andy Ramaj, on the podcast a while back, and he started this thing. He's a British guy. He started this thing called 1 Year No Beer. And it's basically for normal people who are like, you know what? Like, my job, I have to go out. I have to socialize. I have to go entertain clients, and I have to drink, and I'm just tired of it, and I'm sick of feeling like shit the next day. But I just feel like I have to do it, or, you know, it's just part of my social environment. Like, how do I step out of that? And he created this really amazing movement that empowered a lot of people, continues to empower a lot of people to liberate themselves from the shackles of that kind of thing. And I think that is, you know, sort of socially, at least in the United States, I don't know what it's like in Australia, young people are not drinking in the way that young people were drinking when I was in my 20s. Like, I think alcohol on some level has fallen out of disfavor, and maybe it's been supplanted by other drugs. I don't know. I'm an old man now, but
I think there's a different enjoy a reefer from time to time. There is some reefer.
They do. Right? Yeah. A little bit.
Yeah. I don't want to be misunderstood. That nothing that I said is inconsistent with the proposition that there is also a variety of human reactions to these substances, right?
Right.
I mean, I don't want to be understood as saying that these things are always going to lead to calamity for everybody. Clearly, they don't. For the vast majority of people think that they're managing them. The point is, what is the nature of the relationship between a Homo sapien or a mammal and a thing that functions in this way? And, you know, sugar functions in the same way. So, but anything that is giving you this kind of hit in diminishing returns has the same dynamic. Some people are more susceptible to it than others. But what I found liberating about Alan Carr's way of looking at the world, he's dead now, so I don't know why I'm talking about him, but like this model rather than 12 steps was... it didn't have to be a problem with me. I wasn't broken. You are the master here, and I am a mere sensei in terms of the level of alcoholism that we're talking about. I didn't get to those kinds of depths, and maybe if I had, then 12 steps would have worked more effectively. But I just remember thinking, so there's this thing in my brain that says it would like a drink, but the great thing is, that's like that thing doesn't have any hands and legs, and it doesn't have any money, so I don't have to give it the drink that it wants, actually, you know. It's just a function of drinking. Of course I think that I'm a drinker. Of course a drinker would think that they want to drink. But how liberating to know that that's the game that the substance plays with you, with everybody.
Sure.
That's the trick. Anyway, so that's, I just thought that was interesting. I mean, this also, when you're talking about the 1 year no beer, and like, how would I go through life if I wasn't drinking? And the amount of nonsensical bullshit that our brains throw up when we're thinking about, but how would I go out to dinner if I wasn't going to have a glass of wine? How would I go out to the bar if I wasn't going to drink with friends? And then when you're not drinking, you just go, well, I just either have a zero beer, or I have a soda water, or I have a whatever else I want. It's totally fine. I have a Diet Coke. Well, you probably... Do you drink you wouldn't drink a fake sweetener?
Sparkling water, I'm good with that. Like, I don't know. I mean, I think the point that you're trying to make, though, is we get caught up in our head in this obsessive way about how we're being perceived by others. And once you kind of step outside of that and you're like, well, I went to the thing and I had my Diet Coke or my sparkling water and no one gave a shit, because we underestimate the extent to which people are self-obsessed. Like, they don't care. They're not paying attention. They're thinking about themselves.
And we do think that the substance is giving us a lot more fun than it is. That's the funny thing. Like, I did a month without booze a few years ago, and I had someone else was paying for a business class flight from Sydney to LA, and I was thinking 15 hours in business class with all that free booze, and I'm not going to have a single sip. Like, what a miserable experience that's going to be. I'm going to get to the lounge at the airport with all the free booze, and I'm not going to have a single drink. It's going to be misery. A lounge without booze is just a room. I mean, all of a sudden, I'm just in a room, you know, whereas it's a playground of pleasure and plenty when I can have as many bourbon and Cokes as I want. But of course, at the other end of the flight, I was like, oh, that was great. That was cool. That was really nice. I got to watch, I got to read more than I would have. I got to pay more attention to the movies and enjoy them more. It was completely illusory, which I want to bring this round to veganism and to eating meat and to the difficulty of shaking that habit as well. I don't know if you heard Sam Harris name checked you in a recent chat that I had with him. Have a listen. Should you avoid any factory farmed products?
Yeah, I mean, my answer here won't satisfy certainly any vegan. I was vegetarian for 6 years, and then for another, I think a year after, many years after that. Every time I've been a vegetarian, I feel like I've been less healthy. Now, you're going to hear from all the vegetarians and vegans who will tell me I'm an idiot and that there's obviously a straightforwardly healthy way to do both of those things. That may be the case, but the truth is I'm, apart from a few vegans who seem to have made their veganism truly a full-time job, I'm not in the habit of seeing lots of vegans who seem especially healthy, right? I just honestly, you vegans have a problem if you think you're advertising abundant good health to everyone, and it's just readily apparent because I see a lot of vegans who look like they're suffering from their veganism, and so it's I leave Rich Roll out of this, but if you watch Rich Roll videos, you just see how much time and attention goes into him getting his nutrition.
What do you make of that, Rich?
Oh, Sam. I love you, Sam. How do I... So interesting. I mean, first of all, I have a relationship with Sam. I have tons of respect for Sam. I see him socially from time to time. Him and Annika, I would consider not good friends, but, sort of good social acquaintances. And it's funny because that's such a skewed perspective when I hear that from my lived experience. I don't know where he gets the idea that I've made veganism my full-time job. Like at this point, I've been vegan for 16 years and it's so rote for me now that it doesn't feel like an inconvenience in the least, let alone a full-time occupation.
Right,
like,
but that's you're a vegan. I mean, this is the same. I'm making an analogy here between the people on the outside of the glass and the people who are inside the room.
Right.
The person who has not quit alcohol, it seems unimaginably complicated and difficult to navigate life without drinking. And to the person who's done it, it's completely easy. But I think there's a similar dynamic happening with eating meat. And I mean, I don't play you, Sam, in order to troll you or Sam. I play you, Sam, because he's articulating what I think is a very widespread view that I must say I succumb to myself, where I go, I spent 9 months not eating meat. When I was in LA, I was pescatarian. I put on a bit of weight. I was eating way too many carbs. I wasn't doing it right. And eventually I thought, oh, look, I'll come back to this when I figure it out. But I didn't subsequently figure it out. So then I made a pact with myself about not eating factory farmed meat and only eating organic meat and not eating meat when I'm at restaurants, but, eating it and blah, 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 blah. And it becomes like the self-bargaining that was happening when I was trying to avoid quitting alcohol and being like, okay, I'll only drink on weekends. I'm only going to have 5 drinks at a time, whatever those rules might be. So what are we missing?
I think that we tend to overcomplicate it in our minds. And, I've been on an evolution with this. you know, at first it was about losing weight and vanity, and now it's become much more about the broader concerns around sustainable agriculture and animal suffering and the like. And I've always kept it very simple, Josh. Like, on some level, eating plant-based is really like pauper food. Like, I keep it basic. Like, I eat tons of beans and lentils, and I eat veggie burritos, and I eat big salads. You know, I benefit from the fact that my wife is a phenomenal cook and she makes, you know, marvelous meals. But, you know, I also travel a lot and I've been all over the world, and I don't spend a lot of time prepping meals or, you know, doing any of that. Like, I've always figured it out. And that doesn't mean that I've been perfect in that regard, but I still, you know, I'm 56. I feel good in my body. I work out and, you know, I'm able to maintain or build muscle mass. Like, it hasn't impaired me in any particular way. And I think in Sam's case, to speak to that, I think that he is burdened by a sense of ethical dilemma, because I think that he would like to be vegan. And I, as he's spoken about in his podcast, he knows that eschewing animal products is the ethical choice to make. And for some reason, he hasn't been able to do it in a way where he feels like he's being sustained in a healthy way. I've offered to help him. I'd be happy to help him figure that out. Perhaps he's genetically wired in a way where it's not working for him. I can't speak to that. All I can tell you is that I feel good in my body, and as long as I continue to feel good and my blood work is fine and all of that, I'm going to continue to do it. But I also think we're in this weird time right now where, you know, for many years, decades ago, if you wanted to eat vegan or plant-based, like, there weren't really any options that were at least, you know, tasty from a culinary perspective. You had to, you know, be a kind of granola person in order to make it work. And now we're in this situation where there's all these vegan alternatives, meat and dairy analogs, and a lot of the food companies have figured out how to make certain products, if not, you know, taste exactly like their meat and dairy, you know, versions, close enough. But these foods are highly processed. And so you can delude yourself into thinking like, oh, I'm eating vegan, I'm healthy, but you're really not in any better of a position than you would be if you were eating the real thing, right? Mm. So it's never been easier to be an unhealthy vegan person. Yeah. And so you kind of have to go back to the basics. Like, are the foods that you're eating like real food, whole foods? And I think that takes it, that adds an added layer of like maybe complexity or confusion, but it's actually pretty cheap to eat this way. And, you know, I'm pretty content, you know, eating these types of foods all the time. Go ahead.
It is interesting that you say, I mean, I'm just thinking about the wide availability of vegan foods and the fact that you can go into a restaurant or a cafe in any big city in the, you know, in at least in the Anglo world, and you can say, mm-hmm. you know, you're a vegan, and they'll have an option for
sure.
You.
And that didn't used to be the case, of course.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, you can go and coach Sam Harris all you like, but you can't coach the other, you know, several billion people who think like him and me, who feel like, you know, okay, well, Rich says it's easy, but when Rich goes to Italy and he's in a little denominazione comunale, like village where they do things the same way that they have done things for centuries or millennia even, and that involves cheeses and that involves, you know, milk products and dairy and honey and things like that, what does he do? That does sound like it would be hard. And it sounds like to me you would be missing something. It sounds to me like I would very much be missing something if I was on a road trip in France and I couldn't eat any cheese, or if I was on a road trip in Italy and I couldn't eat any prosciutto.
Yeah, I mean, I think that goes back to your earlier point about not being able to drink on your, you know, business class flight from Sydney to LA. And I think I've gotten so much out of this lifestyle that I don't look at it from that kind of martyred perspective. And, you know, I've just found that I've always managed to find a way. And even if I'm in Italy in some village, you know, I can get some form of, you know, gnocchi or, you know, a pasta that's not made with eggs or something like that. Like I've never really, it's not always the most convenient, but it's never been so burdensome where I thought this isn't worth it or it's too difficult. And you know, my health has benefited from it, and I've done it in a way where it doesn't monopolize my life. It's not my full-time job. And when Sam talks about like the, if you watch the videos that Rich Roll makes, you realize it's his full-time job. I'm not sure which videos he's talking about. Like most of the videos that I post are me sitting in a chair talking to somebody in my podcast.
So yeah, but he can see, you can see that in deep inside you're tormented by your lack of
people. Yeah, I guess. Right?
I mean, it's look, I'm sure it's easy. It's just, it is one of those things where like, you know,
and I've tried, but you have our mutual friend Osher, I'm sure would be happy to help you because he's all about it.
True. That's true. Yeah. Osher is a TV, popular TV host, the host of The Bachelor.
And let me just say to, you know, put a kind of button on this, Josh. You know, I made a promise to myself that when I started this lifestyle, that I would not be, you know, overly dogmatic about it. And should I start to, you know, suffer health-wise in any way, that I would, you know, be objective about the whole thing and give myself permission to change course or pivot. And, you know, that just hasn't happened. And I would say that when we look at food systems and we look at the food that we're eating, there's personal health. And I think, you know, at least, you know, in America, it's like, it's all about like me and how I feel. Like, do I feel good? Do I not feel good? And that's important, of course. We all want to be healthy. I found that eating a whole food plant-based diet has given me the sustenance that I need, such that it's powered me through athletic endurance challenges that most people are not interested in and will never, you know, push themselves through. So it satisfies the category of being enough to, you know, make me the athlete that I aspired to be. But beyond that, I think it's important for all of us to consider our food choices and our consumer choices more broadly in the context of how they're affecting others, the planet, et cetera. And a whole food plant-based diet not only allows you to avoid the processed foods and other foods that are contributing to like unnecessary suffering in human health in the form of the rise of all of these, you know, chronic lifestyle diseases that are debilitating millions of people across the world, in the form of type 2 diabetes and obesity and all these sorts of things.
But these are illnesses of processed food. These are not illnesses of eating animal products per se. I mean, you know, Joe Rogan will, you know, be able to eat as many animal products and be fit and healthy too, right?
Yeah, but I think that there's a longer conversation that's probably better had with nutritionists and doctors and scientists around the impact of excessive saturated fat intake into your diet, et cetera, that are contributing to heart disease, et cetera. And so,
get a lot of saturated fat from coconut milk or whatever substitutes you might vegan substitutes
using. It's different, or, you know, I don't want to get too sidetracked on that, but like my saturated fat intake is so much lower. And then again, just to get into then there's the environmental concerns, like the impact of the food choices that we're making and how are these foods made and where are they coming from and what is that doing to our environment, and to opt out of this factory farming insanity that, you know, is creating all of this suffering, you know, for no other reason than perhaps a karmic, you know, reason to not participate in that, you know, is, you know, something that I feel good about. And it's not that eating plant-based, you know, obviates you from harm or anything like that. I'm not trying to overstate the case, but, you know, we vote with our dollar and we do that with the food that we eat and the other products that, you know, we, the companies that we patronize.
Yeah. I think it's insightful to notice the analogy between the Italian or French road trip and the business class flight. Because I do, I hadn't really thought about that before, but I myself do, when I think about becoming vegetarian, think about, you know, that one great steak that I have, you know, once or twice a year at some fancy restaurant, or that incredible meal that I have on the Greek islands where they're bringing me sardines and burrata and fresh tomatoes and, you know, whatever else it might be. But that, the fear of losing that is not a good justification for having eaten ground beef in my tacos last night instead of just having beans.
You know, right. What I mean? It's the same thing when you're considering.
It's not going up drinking booze every single day because I might want to have a glass of champagne at my daughter's wedding in 20 years.
Exactly. It's exactly the same thing. Like when somebody's getting sober and they say, you know, in 9 months, I have to go to this bachelor party in Vegas. How am I ever going to get through that without drinking? You know, or I'm going to go to Italy, you know, when I retire and I want to be able to eat X, Y, and Z. Yeah, but what are you eating today? What are you eating tomorrow? Like that's, you know, it's like instead of focusing on peak experiences and, you know, the outer edges these possible experiences that you want to have in your life, like let's focus on the day in and the day out.
Yeah. And cross that bridge when you come from it. Good when you come to it. Mm-hmm. You may not want it. I mean, now I would previously have thought I can't drive around the south of France without, you know, drinking red wine with each meal as well. But now I do that and that's not a problem at all. And am I missing something? I guess culturally I'm missing out on the culture of French wine drinking, but that's not something that I value in my life at the moment. So I don't miss it. I mean, I think just to wrap up on this point, the point that Sam is making about the PR is that there are people like you and like my friend Osha, who's also a prominent Australian vegan, who look fantastic, who like obviously have their shit together physically and are in peak form. And then there's the kind of gray, pale, nose ring, dreadlocked 22-year-old girl vegan who is not doing the publicity any favors. And I mean, does he have a point there? Or is because there is some kind of publicity problem with veganism?
Yeah,
like, yeah. I would at a tipping point where morally anybody who thinks it through understands that this is probably the easiest example of something that we're all doing that in 100 years time, people are going to look back on and go, I can't believe that people thought that was okay to do the way that factory farming functions at least.
Sure.
So yeah, I think eventually where we have this cognitive dissonance, and maybe part of the impediment is a preconception that we have about what veganism entails and does to our bodies.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an astute observation. Certainly, you know, factory farming universally, you know, it's a bipartisan issue. We're all in favor of the eradication of factory farming. And I think that deep down, nobody likes the idea that animals have to suffer for our food, but we've made this decision that it's sort of an unfortunate necessity for human health. And when somebody steps outside of that and says, actually, you don't have to do that at all and you can be healthy, that is either, you know, sort of received welcome in a welcome way by a certain small sector of the population, and another perhaps larger swath of the world will be threatened by that because that is a challenge to their value set and it requires them to look inward and question this assumption that they've made that eating animals is a necessity, which obviates any kind of ethical considerations around that. So that becomes a sticky wicket, I think. And then to your point around publicity, I think that, you know, vegans are often their own worst publicists, and there's a real problem within the movement in terms of how this lifestyle is communicated and advocated in that, it's inherently, you know, a lifestyle that's about compassion. And yet there's sort of an acerbic tone of judgment and condescension that is levied from certain aspects of that community at others that is not helpful. And I also think within the vegan plant-based community, there's a lot of infighting and argumentation about how to communicate the benefits of this lifestyle or what's important and what's not, that hinders the progress of it and alienates, you know, many, many people out there. And there's an interesting parallel between, at least in the United States, Democratic and Republican politics in the way they mirror each other, in the sense that, like, vegans are sort of like Democrats. They're always fighting with each other. They're arguing about what their talking points are. The right wing, they've got it all in lockstep. They're always on point with what they're saying. And that would mimic the more kind of carnivore paleo perspective when it comes to diet. And so I think the infighting within the plant-based community and the different factions and perspectives end up at times, you know, alienating people who might be curious about it otherwise. And so I've thought a lot about how to be the best advocate for this lifestyle. And I've really abandoned trying to convince anybody that, you know, they should do what I do. Like, I'm not in the business of trying to get to convince people that they should live their life or eat the way that I do. And that's very much an outgrowth of what I've learned in 12-step. Like, in 12-step, you don't tell people what to do. You don't give them advice. You share your experience. So I'm happy to share my experience. If that's meaningful to somebody else and they can extract something from that that's beneficial to them, that's fantastic. If somebody asks me about why I eat the way that I eat or what it does for me or doesn't do for me, happy to talk about it. But I don't stand in judgment of anybody else's choices. I'm not taking anyone else's inventory. I would much prefer to just, you know, have a sort of pursue my life and try to live well and be a lighthouse, like to just stand in my strength and attract people who are, you know, vibrating on my wavelength and are possibly receptive to what I have to say. But I'm not out there banging any kind of drum. Like, that's just not the way to, you know, kind of win a war of ideas from my perspective.
Right. Be the change you want to see in the world, as Gandhi said.
Yeah, just go out and live a kick-ass life and be an example for other people.
As I'm trying to think through what's working and what works and what doesn't work on someone like me, I would regard myself as being the cohort that's most winnable, the cohort that is basically sold on the morality of it. What derails me sometimes is the number of arguments, as you just said, from the vegan side, some of which are of varying quality, and our brains just will naturally latch onto the weakest argument and then try to take that one down and then think that and then feel like we've done a good job of dismissing all the arguments because we've dismissed the weakest one. So, you know, it happened just a moment ago when you were talking about all the health problems from eating too much saturated fat. You know, I smell a rat there and I go, well, hang on. What you're actually talking about is the overconsumption of processed food and having too much saturated fat and not enough lean protein, all of which are manageable within the context of a healthy carnivorous, omnivorous diet. And then I think, well, because I've made that distinction, therefore I can skip merrily on my way and not worry about the other arguments for veganism that I regard as being more sound, which are the more kind of Peter Singer-based moral arguments about whether or not we've reached a stage of human conscious evolution that makes it untenable for us to treat other sentient creatures in simply as objects of our own use anymore. And if there was a clarity, I think if there was a clarity of messaging around the moral question, then maybe that would be clearer. I don't know. I want to get to first date questions, which I will pepper at you in a kind of a Rorschach test of random questions, and you could just say the first thing that comes into your mind. But before we get to those, I'm just interested in where you think of what you think of your goals and role as being at the moment? Like, are you an athlete? Are you an activist? Are you an interviewer? Are you a guru? You were just talking about people vibrating on your wavelength. Like, what is your role at this point?
Definitely not a guru. Definitely not a guru. It's a curious question. I try not to overly identify in any kind of particular silo. I am athletic. I'm not a competitor. I'm not competing as an athlete right now. Does that make me an athlete? Does it not? Like, I'm not sure. Like, all I can tell you is that, in terms of goals, there are certainly creative projects that I'm trying to realize right now, but I'm not the person who's like, I'm doing all of this to work towards this ultimate thing. Like, this, I have my eyes on this prize off in the distance. Like, I just feel so incredibly grateful to be able to do what I get to do every day, which is like, have amazing conversations with fascinating people who inspire me and educate me in different ways. And of course, we all want our platforms to grow and reach more people. And, my ego will get caught up in that as much as the next person. But, the truth of the matter, Josh, is that, like, if it was lights out tomorrow, like, it was a life well lived. Like, I'm so nourished in what I get to do today. And so, like, sort of semi-shocked that I get to do this thing and support my family in doing it, that it doesn't necessarily need to be anything more than what it is right now. And in terms of, like, how people perceive me as an athlete, as a podcaster, as an author, whatever it is, that's their business. Like, I try to not get caught up in what that might look like. I guess, in terms of the amount of time that I spend on certain things, I'm probably most appropriately labeled as a podcaster because that's how I, invest most of my time. But I'm working on a new book, and, I would like to do a race at some point in the future if I can get my back sorted out. And, I've got 4 kids, and I have the privilege of being able to do lots of different things and be exposed to many different interesting experiences. And I look at it all as the real privilege, I guess, in all of this, is, I guess what I'm driving at is I'm in this unbelievable position where I get to choose how to invest my curiosity. And I that is a gift that not many people get in their life. And I'm very aware of that. And so how I choose to deploy that curiosity is something that I, take very seriously. And right now it's podcasting and this book thing, and, we'll see where that goes. But I don't get caught up in 5-year plans or 10-year plans or anything like that. I mean, I'd be curious how you think about that.
5-year plans and 10-year plans.
Yeah, your goal? Like, where do you see yourself in 5 years? Like, where are you taking all of this, Josh? You know what I mean?
I mean, my answer is easier to the question that I actually asked you rather than the one that you've turned it into, in the sense of like, what are you up to? I mean, I'm up to having conversations that help people feel a bit more sane in the world and that move things forward in a way that's constructive and that avoids mischaracterization of people's ideas and that creates a stronger and sort of more robust demos in which we can have conversations and figure out problems and create solutions to the shared problems that we face rather than squabbling with each other over irrelevant things or over misunderstandings about each other's positions. I'm on a mission against tribalism and identitarianism and in favor of the greatest amount of kind of compassion and empathy and sort of intellectual empathy and as well as emotional empathy that we can muster to come together and understand each other and be well informed about the world. So that is for me a very kind of simple box in which I can sit. And then the questions about exactly where I will be in 5 or 10 years all stem from that in a way that I feel is more consistent for me than if I was running ultramarathons and doing a podcast and being an activist, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. No, I get that. I get that.
Let's talk about first. Let's do first aid questions. We've only scratched the surface. I mean, I'm not. I have a bazillion other questions that I could ask you about your life and everything that's going on in the world. We haven't even touched on culture war stuff or anything like that. But what's happening now that in 20 years people will look back on and laugh about?
Laugh about or be surprised, find humorous, you think?
No. Well, you can take it either way. Like, either shake your head in disbelief or have a chuckle. Mm.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Well, I think certainly, and this is my, I'm going to be Mr. Vegan guy. Like, the idea that we eat animals, I think in maybe not 20 years, but perhaps in 50 years, people will look back and wonder, young people will wonder, like, wait, you actually raised these animals and slaughtered them or, all of that. That's how you got your food. I think that will seem weird with the advent of the cultured meat movement, which is well underway right now. So I think that's certainly a possibility. I mean, my hope is that the institution of democracy, at least in the United States, will survive this strange moment that we find ourselves in, and perhaps we'll look back on this time curiously as a very strange moment in our history, and that the ship will be sufficiently righted and we'll be able to restore some level of confidence in institutions and find our way back to reasoned civil discourse. But I don't know. I think that could go either way.
Yeah. Would you rather live full time in an RV or full time on a sailboat?
Probably an RV. Because I don't know how to sail right now. Although I love the water. If I knew how to sail, I'd probably say a sailboat.
I think we can teach you how to sail.
I'd probably say a sailboat.
I think that's within the realm of your ability. I'm not going to put you on the sailboat today and keep you there and you're not allowed to dock or learn. I think you'll have some
The ports of call for the sailboat are much more intriguing and exotic than the RV, place where you sleep, you pull over off the side of the highway to sleep. So fine. I think sailing sounds a little bit sexier and more inspiring.
Yeah. Yeah. What's a cool place that you haven't been to that you want to go to?
Japan. My 19-year-old daughter just got back from 3 weeks in Japan with her boyfriend. It changed her life. I've always wanted to visit and have yet to go there.
What's the worst movie you've seen?
I love me a bad movie. bad or bad it's good?
I don't think this means so bad it's good. I'm usually asking for the least enjoyable film, not one that's so bad. My camp.
Oh man, I'm gonna have to really think about that. I see a lot of movies. And
well, what's a recent one that you walked out of going, "Oh, that was a dud"?
Oh man, am I really gonna say this on a podcast? I did not enjoy Avatar.
Oh, the second movie. One. Wow. Yeah.
And I know the Camerons, and so I feel bad. And I feel like the themes of the movie I appreciate, but I had a really hard time with the CGI nature of everything. And well, I'm not a Marvel guy.
It is an entirely CGI film. Are you aware? Did you know that
I did. Yes, I did. I did know that.
What is this? I thought I was going to get real flying animals.
I don't like the 3D glasses experience, right, and where everything, just looks so not real. It takes me out of the narrative, and it made it impossible for me to enjoy the movie.
That's so interesting.
Because I was so distracted by the rest of it.
Were you expecting to enjoy it?
I tried to go in with this blank a slate as possible. But no, I wasn't expecting it to be amazing. But you know, I was expecting to be so bored.
I just caught it just before it was about to go off in the theaters. I was like, if I'm ever going to see it, I have to see it on a gigantic screen in 3D. So let's go and do it. And I was like, I don't want to sit through the flying blue things. And the, I don't want to spend three. I'm going to be looking at my watch after 2 hours going, I'm only halfway through. But I loved it. I didn't get bored at all.
You did?
I was like.
Interesting.
But I think it's because I had such low expectations. I was like, it wasn't boring. It was really impressive. It was, you know, I liked the story. I liked the big flying things. It was like being on a little ride. Mm. I thought it was great. I didn't like Tar.
Oh, man. I thought Tar was the best movie of the year.
Wow.
I think in 5 or 10 years, we'll be looking back and really having a different, you know, perspective on that movie. I thought that movie was brilliant.
It may have been also that I saw it late. I saw it late, and I was kind of tired. Mm. And I was like, you know, okay.
And I saw it a second time. I enjoyed it even more the second time.
You went back?
Yeah, I love Tar.
Wow, you're a glutton.
Mm.
For punishment. That's incredible.
I encourage you to go back and
there is absolutely
when you feel fresh.
I will ever watch that movie again. I wouldn't be able to sit through the 13-minute long musical credit sequence at the beginning that they force you to sit through, like this is some 1942 melodrama before you even get to anything happening in the movie. I'd walk out within 90 seconds.
You know there's a purposeful meaning behind that.
I'm sure there is. What's the purposeful meaning?
I think it speaks to one of the themes of the movie is putting to the test the lie or the idea of the sole genius, you know, the self-invented genius who stands apart from the rest of humanity. And I think Todd Field, in making this movie, was saying not only is Lydia Tarr, not the sort of genius fabricated character that she, you know, she's a product of her own self-creation. Like her stature and sort of position in that world is the result of so many people behind the scenes, all of the musicians, all of these people that help to, you know, create the work that makes her, you know, the person that she is in that world. Similarly, Todd Field, right up front in making this movie, is saying, look at how many people it takes to make a movie like this, just because, you know, my name as the director is front and center on this whole thing. Let's be clear at the very beginning, like, I want you to appreciate like the thousands of people that contribute to, you know, a work such as this. And I thought that was a cool, creative way of you know, basically exploring that theme that plays out over the course of that film.
That is one interpretation. I like that one. The alternative interpretation is it's a way to virtue signal to audiences about how creative and important this movie is, and that he's going to force you to.
I will grant you there's a level of self-importance in it.
Exactly. Strap yourself in because this is an epic which is going shooting for the stars and is going to win all the Oscars. Just sit there and endure these 5 minutes of boredom before I start pulling my pants down and showing you my dick. It's like, okay, we get it, Todd. We get it. You're being very creative here.
That Berlin apartment was pretty dope, though.
It was. It was a lovely apartment. I loved that. What's the worst advice that someone's given you, Rich?
That's a tough one. I think I would say...
G'day, humans. If you'd like to hear Rich's answer to the worst advice he's ever been given and my reaction to that answer, you can get your own dedicated premium podcast feed for free at uncomfortableconversations.substack.com/listen. That'll generate your unique podcast feed to keep, and it'll always contain more content than the feed that you are listening to does. If not, have a great week, and I'll see you next time.